Wisconsin remains one of the most polarized states in the Union. We talk with Craig Gilbert about a new reporting project he's embarking on that will take him to Trump country. And now it's official. Wisconsin has a contract with Foxconn. But what kind of taxpayer protections are in this final deal? And Governor Walker announces his bid for re-election. And strangely enough, he's downplaying the Foxconn deal. What does his own polling show? All that and more today from the best political reporters in Wisconsin on Politics. I'm David Haynes. I'm the opinions editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome to On Politics. Well, we spoke with Craig Gilbert just a few moments ago about a project that he's beginning to report on in western Wisconsin. Let's go to Craig. Well, Craig, welcome back to On Politics. You are now embarking on a major reporting project as part of a fellowship at the Marquette University Law School. You're sort of looking again at polarization in the state. Why don't you broad brush, give us what you're doing, and then talk about a story you have coming this weekend.
Yep. So over the next several months, I'm going to be traveling around the state, talking to voters, kind of looking analytically at sort of the political landscape and the political climate in the state in the aftermath of the Trump election and in the run-up to the Trump midterms. Wisconsin's in a really interesting place, having voted for Trump and helped propel him to the White House. And so we've got, you know, a lot of action in our midterm elections. So it's an interesting place to keep an eye on. The first story, I went to southwestern Wisconsin, which is an area that's always fascinated me, because for a white rural area, it's very purple, it's very competitive, and it flipped really hard toward Donald Trump in this last election. It's a really swingy area. It's interesting for lots of reasons. It's gotten a lot of attention since the election because of these big election swings from double-digit Obama to single-digit Trump. So wow. I spent some time roaming around a really beautiful area of the state and talking to a lot of really interesting people.
Yeah, so what are you finding so far? Why do people, why that big swing? Any clues so far?
Yeah, well, several things. I mean, Trump certainly had some appeal as kind of a populist. He really tapped into a deep kind of political frustration, not so much partisanship, but political frustration across the board. I found, you know, it really reinforced the notion that a big part of the story was kind of negativity toward Hillary Clinton. More people told me that it was a vote against Hillary Clinton than it was a vote for Donald Trump. And also, this is just, you know, it's an economically challenged area, but it's also a really swingy area. So, you know, it's not at all clear that this is, at least in this part of the state, that this is part sort of a tidal shift from one party to the other, as much as it is a very swingy group of voters who swung really hard for Obama in 2008 and then swung really hard for Trump this time. But what I really found was that a year after the election, which was an expression of political frustration, there's still a ton of political frustration. People really don't like what they're seeing in politics. They really don't like what they're seeing in Washington. And it's in all directions. I mean, Trump voters are unhappy. Not even Trump voters are unhappy with his behavior and with his tweets. People grouse about the media. They grouse about the inability of the parties to work together, the fact that nothing seems to be happening. Just kind of a wellspring of frustration, of political frustration. People are frustrated also with the political culture and the fact that it's so divisive. So just broad discontent is what I've found.
Well, we saw some of that in Virginia this week, right? Talk for just a minute about that to wrap up.
Yeah, now Virginia, very different kind of battleground, kind of more upscale suburbs. I mean, the part of the state I went to in Wisconsin really doesn't have cities or suburbs of any size. So really different demographic. But you saw an area where Trump is quite unpopular in these, you know, populous suburbs in places like Virginia, New Jersey, and other places. And this is really where Democrats hope to make their gains in Congress next year. So it's a bad sign for Republicans what happened in those states. We don't know yet how broad the lessons are that can be taken from it. But when you combine what happened Tuesday with, you know, what I think I found and saw in a very different kind set of communities, it's, you know, it is, there are danger signs there. It's not that people are crazy about the Democratic Party. God knows they've got their trouble in with rural voters, certainly. But what's happening in Washington right now is not really, I think, satisfying people's desire to see kind of less noise and more action.
All right, Craig Gilbert, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
So we now have a Foxconn deal, and I spoke with Jason Stein of our Capital Bureau about that. Here's Jason. Well, Jason, thanks for being on Politics. We have a final, or at least mostly final, deal contract for Foxconn. Tell us what you know about it.
Well, there's a lot of things that we knew going all the way back to the July White House announcement of this Foxconn contract. $3 billion to the company, most of it in cash. But we are seeing for the first time some additional new requirements on the company to create jobs, as well as levels that if job employment at the factory fell below, that the company would have to pay back, you know, some of the very substantial tax credits that taxpayers are going to give them.
So there's some clawbacks. And one of the issues was there were no job requirements for a large portion of this money at $1.35 billion, right, if I recall, for plant and equipment. Right. But now there are, right?
Correct. So this deal is sort of divided into two big buckets of tax credits that will probably be paid out to the company in the form of cash if the company earns them year over year. And one of those buckets is on jobs being created. So those, they're always, the company was going to have to create jobs to get these tax credits. On the other side, though, the company can also earn them by just investing in the plant. And so there had been a concern that if the plant turned out to be very highly automated, it could get almost half of the tax credits without creating a lot of jobs. Now that is really explicitly written into the contract that the company will, you know, to get into the billions of dollars of tax credits, the company will have to create thousands of jobs.
And the chairman of Foxconn, Terry Goh, is putting up to $500 million of as a personal guarantee. Isn't that correct?
There's a very significant guarantee within the contract. On the jobs part, it's up to $500 million. It could be, you know, even more than that if the company does, you know, more serious things like lies to the state. But at that $500 million for jobs, Terry Goh is personally guaranteeing one quarter of that. And the parent company of Foxconn called Hon Hai is guaranteeing the other three quarters. So at least you're getting that guarantee from the biggest corporate entity and the one that's, you know, most likely to still be in business 10 or 15 years from now.
Do you know yet from your reporting how that personal guarantee came about? Mark Hogan said yesterday that's highly unusual, and I think he's right about that.
I think that's right. For a publicly traded company to have, you know, an individual, you know, for the chairman to personally guarantee something is unusual. I think it also needs to be said that the contract itself is an unusually rich series of incentives. So there's, you know, it's unusual on that side as well. We're still doing reporting, but I asked four times yesterday when the state had asked for that personal guarantee. Was not told that. So there are some indications that came in the final weeks of negotiating the contract as the state really tried to grapple with whether or not it was providing all the protections needed for taxpayers.
So let's talk about the secrecy issue as well. There was a lot of criticism. I wrote a column criticizing the process for being secretive yesterday. What was that all about? Have you done any reporting on that aspect of the deal?
Sure. I mean, I think you can say two things about it. One, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which was voting on this contract, the board yesterday, was using its normal procedures, which call for voting on these things in secret. However, what is different in this case, one is that it's such a big deal, and two, that often the WEDC has these contracts behind closed doors and no one knows about them. And so you don't want Oklahoma to know that we're cherry picking a company away from them. But, you know, in this case, all the other states competing for this Foxconn plant, they knew what we were offering Foxconn. It was announced at the White House. So, you know, in this case, some of the normal arguments for secrecy did not really apply. But the WDC just went with their usual process in spite of that.
And finally, we talked about this earlier offline, but this still remains a pretty good deal for Foxconn, right? What are the percentages in terms of subsidies for jobs and plant and equipment?
Right. So many people keep asking me, well, what is the sly way, that backdoor way that Foxconn might get a good deal out of this contract? I mean, the front door that it announced details of the contract are really what's a good deal for Foxconn, and they are 17 cents on the dollar of qualifying wages that Foxconn pays will be paid for by state of Wisconsin taxpayers, and 15 cents on the dollar of the capital investments in the plant and equipment that the company makes. So obviously, I mean, that's a kind of deal that not many companies get. The state says it's worth it. You know, we're going to find out, I think, in the coming years.
All right, Jason Stein, thanks so much.
Thank you, David.
So now I'm joined in our Milwaukee studio by Mary Spacuzza, reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Dan Bice, a columnist at the Journal Sentinel. Well, Governor Walker announced his reelection bid this week, and here's what he had to say.
I'm pleased. I am thrilled on behalf of our outstanding Lieutenant Governor, Rebecca Clayfish, and I, to announce today that Rebecca and I are asking for 4 more years to serve as your governor.
Well, Governor Walker's going to run. I guess we knew that, Dan.
His approval ratings are as strong as they've ever, as strong as they've been since he announced he was running for president.
Let's talk a little bit about Foxconn, though. He's not talking much about the Foxconn deal. Why not? Yeah, 13,000 jobs. Why wouldn't you tout that?
And it's a place where he has a weakness, because he said he was going to create 250,000 jobs, and he's yet to do that. But the problem is the public's not completely sold on this. You know, there have been 2 polls on it that showed people were pretty evenly divided, the public policy polling and the Marquette poll. In the Marquette poll, it showed that people thought 13,000 jobs was a great thing, but they weren't so much sold on the $3 billion cost. And, you know, this is their deal, the Republicans' deal and Scott Walker's deal, and they have to live with what happens. And so, you know, I just think it's, you know, he reads poll numbers as well as anybody, and those who've been through his emails and other stuff know he reads poll numbers more than just about anyone else. So I think, you know, he didn't want to bring up something that right now is a polarizing issue when he's announcing his third term.
So, Mary, it's always about who you're running against.
Unless you don't know. I mean, there's obviously, they went from having very, you know, not many people stepping forward to a whole lot of people stepping forward, and likely more. So obviously, you know, Governor Walker's campaign is not sure who they're going to be up against. I'm sure there's plenty of opposition research being done on all of the candidates and possible candidates on this point. Sure.
We've already been writing some of that stuff already.
Right. The questions about Tony Evers and the teacher who was viewing some pornography on a work computer and is still a teacher. So I think that I'm sure they're very busy with their opposition research, but I don't think they're really, you know, probably targeting Tony Evers, but I don't think they're going to go after every single possible Democratic candidate full bore until they know who they're going to be running against. Right. But Tony Evers is probably at the top of their list.
How's the Trump factor going to play in 2018? Any way to read that at this point? I mean, Virginia, that we talked about it with Craig just a minute ago, that was a blowout. Mm-hmm. Any chance that could play into the governor's race?
Sure. I mean, it has. You know, remember when then President Obama took a shellacking in midterm elections when people were dissatisfied with what the Dems were doing nationally? Yeah. So I think it always does. You know, Walker's had a very interesting relationship with Trump, not quite as interesting maybe as Paul Ryan has, but they clearly ran against each other. Trump talked about sending him packing like a little boy and talked about
what
a disaster he's been. Right.
So
Walker didn't endorse him.
And one thing was the difficulty with polling. All of the polls showed that suburban women did not like him, but when it came time to vote, did not like
Trump.
And when it came time to vote, 53% of white women end up voting for Trump. So, you know, it's a hard thing to gauge what's going to happen with the Trump factor. You guys published the Christian Schneider's piece suggesting that Trump being in the race was harmful to the Democrats. I had a hard time figuring out that argument. because it seems that despite the fact that Walker's not a fan of Donald Trump, they are on the same side of the aisle.
Well, and he worked with them on the Foxconn deal, which is sort of interesting too. Foxconn is going to be an issue in this campaign, don't you think?
Sure, and you know, the one thing that happened that was interesting, the vote took place behind closed doors, but we know the vote was 8-2, and Representative Dana Walks, who is one of the upper-tier Democrats running against it, made his decision and voted against the deal. But, you know, you do have a couple of Democrats who voted for it, but, you know, by next year at this time, Foxconn's probably not going to be resolved yet, and we won't know if they actually bring the 13,000 jobs. And that is a question, because Foxconn has, in other locations, promised a certain number of jobs and then not delivered.
Well, but gotten some money out of the deal.
The contract actually calls for them by next year to have 200 and some jobs. So presumably,
no, but I mean, the whole thing won't be.
You're not going to.
Which is progress, but not 13, not thousands of jobs.
So Mary, Walker has had, in the three campaigns he's run, kind of a formula for how he wins. He wins the ring counties around Milwaukee huge, and then he does very well out state. It's tough for a Democrat to win here, given who Walker is and how he is able
Mr.
to play.
Mr. 53%.
Yeah,
right.
Or 51.5%.
It is. I mean, although I would say during his presidential race that it certainly showed weaknesses for him. He was not a strong presidential candidate. I think he's much more familiar talking about state issues. Mm-hmm. But it also showed that, you know, he was really kind of fumbling to get his footing in that race and was very fast to drop out. And his approval ratings really did take a hit during that time. I don't think Democrats seized on that the way they could have. But it did show that he is maybe not such a tough candidate in all situations.
What it shows is that Wisconsin is not a purple state, as we sometimes say. It's a deeply divided red and blue state. Yeah. And in each of the elections, he gets about 52%, 53%. Yeah. There's a large segment of the population, 47, 48%, who really, really don't like him, who are going to vote against him no matter what. Probably an equal number of Republicans who are going to vote for him no matter what. And the race comes down to, as it's been said in the past, a very small number of people whose ideas about the governor switch back and forth. And, you know, in a couple of these last races, his campaign has been able, in the final weeks of the campaign, to change the, you know, usually with a reelection bid like this, third time, you're wondering if there's some Walker fatigue out there, whether we're starting to get tired of him. But he's been able, in the recall election, to take the focus off of him and to put it on to Tom Barrett and what he had done in terms of creating jobs. And with Mary Burke in the final weeks before election, did she plagiarize her economic plan? Was she fired by Trek? That was the discussion at the end.
That's right.
It's very clever for someone, because usually in those final weeks, it's, has he done what he said he was going to do? Are we better off now? Those sort of questions. But in his last two elections, that was not the case.
Well, let's talk about Tom Barrett. We'll render our next segment.
someone who lost three times to Walker.
Speaking of someone who has been up against the governor in the past, the mayor's budget. Mary, what happened with that this week?
So it got amended on Friday. It went through the budget committee and faced some changes. It'll go to the full Common Council on Friday for passage, and then Barrett will have week and a half or so to review and make decisions about vetoes. So it is to be determined. I don't think it's going to change that dramatically necessarily, but obviously it's been an unpopular budget. There were a lot of amendments, about 64 proposed, that went to the committee. There's the 24-hour packet is out now. Mm-hmm. So, but it's one where, you know, the mayor himself has said he's not particularly proud of this budget, or really not proud of it at all. Common council members have said the same thing. The cuts to public safety are not popular. With all the cuts to public safety, actually, the property tax increase has not even been talked about very much, which is kind of rare. But I think when you're talking about cutting 75 firefighters and 33 police officers, that kind of overshadows a lot of the conversation.
And at the same time, there's the conversation about the Fire Police Commission that's going on as well.
Right, and so he
talk about that a little bit.
The Common Council this week voted to override his veto of this measure that would give them the power to fire police chief or fire chief on a two-thirds vote. And meanwhile, there's been this discussion at the state level. There's a Republican bill to essentially overhaul the Fire and Police Commission, which would give more power to unions. They would actually be able to handpick a former firefighter or former police officer who would serve on it. Political parties would pick if somebody's has a political affiliation. It would completely change the whole appeals process and how somebody is fired and appeals that
and
firing.
Whether
they would get paid during it. So it's really, it would be a gift to
My question for both of you is Barrett showing some political weakness here?
I think he is facing a council that is divided amongst themselves but can kind of unite on these issues where they might feel completely differently about, you know, some might want more police officers and feel like Flynn needs to be tougher on crime, Chief Flynn. Some want less, you know, fewer police officers and are more concerned about things like black incarceration, but they both can agree that they don't like Chief Flynn and they want to be able to fire him. So they come together.
It's not completely unified on the Fire Police Commission. It passed on, 9 votes, but then Ashanti Hamilton flips and gives them the 10th vote on that.
It actually passed on 8 because Donovan was absent that day. But, it was very close, and then Ashanti cast the deciding vote.
So, Dan, Barrett political machine still running on all 8 cylinders?
I mean, he's got the money, but I've been told that that Ashanti had a pretty big fundraiser on on Monday, I think it was, with Carl Miller, and he had an earlier one. With some other big name people. Ashanti is not doing the things that you would expect for someone to run. I mean, he is raising money, which would be a good thing, but, you know, he doesn't have a definitive position on the budget or an alternative to the budget. And to show that, you know, to flip-flop on the Fire and Police Commission thing, that's, again, not the sort of thing you would expect from someone who's planning to run for mayor. So if Ashanti runs, what is his platform? What is his position? Right now, we don't know what that is. But it's not a dumb thing to start raising money in the middle of the budget process. People would want his ear and probably would want to show up at these events.
All right. Well, let's move to our favorite time of the week. Winners and losers.
Yes.
All right.
Mary, I'm going to go with you first.
Okay.
Who's your winner?
I'm going to say Democrats after suffering a lot of election losses a year ago, they actually came back and did very well taking over the governor, no longer Governor Chris Christie, pretty soon. So there's going to be a Democratic governor there.
And his lieutenant governor didn't win.
In New Jersey.
Yeah, yes, in New Jersey. And then Virginia, also a Democratic governor.
Clean sweep pretty much there.
Right. Yeah. And then a lot of other races. There was the first transgender candidate, Danica Rome, if I'm pronouncing that name correctly. The anchor, or the young man whose girlfriend was killed on live TV, former anchor heading into office. Right. He's backs gun control, and then it wasn't really a major part of his platform, but he clearly supports gun control in a state that has, you know, not always gone for candidates that do. So it was a pretty clean
there
sweep.
There is sort of a sub-winner with hers, with that transgender candidate, Danica Rome.
Right.
Chris Abley here, our county exec, put $165,000 of his own money into that race. He's also head of the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund, which put another $53,000. That represented about two-thirds of the money that she raised in that race.
And she defeated a very anti-LGBT
He said he was openly a homophobe.
Right. So, didn't he say, like, chief homophobe
homophobe.
Like that? Big bathroom bill?
Yeah. So, so it was a pretty major victory. She is the first openly transgender candidate. So,
Mary, who's your loser this week?
So, while Chris Abley won on that one, Milwaukee County did not win in this appeal with the pensions of, more than 600 employees. And so that's going to be a hefty price tag with that, unless something changes. So that is less of good news for Chris Abley this
and
week.
And Abley also loses as well.
Right.
He spent about $250,000, still spending about $250,000 to get support for his budget plan and to get his wheel tax, to see the wheel tax double from $30 to $60. And the county board shot that down in pretty strong numbers.
They did. A pretty clear rejection. Yeah, Theo Lipscomb Sr., the head of the county board, wrote a pretty scathing op-ed this week, essentially calling Abley a liar.
I think you have the Abley campaign and machine trying to take down Theo, drive up his negatives with all of these ads, because the ads specifically focus on Theo.
Right, yeah, pretty clearly.
It's his picture.
He's the main character.
And they've set up a website with this just on Theo. Yeah. And he does have an opponent, and a strong opponent, a guy who used to work for Dave Obey and Herb Coles. It's not just somebody,
When's that race?
It's in the
spring.
In the spring, I think. Because it's a nonpartisan race. So
that'll be one to watch. So, Dan, who's your loser this week?
I wrote this week about a guy who refers to himself as the Iron Stash, Randy Bryce. He's getting a lot of good and positive attention everywhere. He's right up in Politico, Mother Jones. We did a nice piece. He's the cover of Milwaukee Magazine this week. Mm-hmm. I looked into some of his past issues, and the fact that he had fallen behind on his child support and was behind for about two years, and he paid it off 2 months after he announced he was going to run. He's also filed for bankruptcy, and he has at least one outstanding judgment, a personal loan that he didn't pay from about 10 years ago, and that's still outstanding. He has some other issues as well. So, after someone announces, we usually go in and focus and do background check. And so those are some of the things that turned up on Randy Bryce.
Randy Bryce.
And they weren't like huge amounts of money, but child support is something that you generally...
It's a tough thing.
Yeah.
And you know, his side was saying this is nothing, but actually to a lot of people, and his opponent, Kathy Myers, a Democrat run against him, she came back and said, I was a single mom and I had to rely on my ex-husband's child support to pay for my kids. And when he came up short, I had to take a second job. So that's, you can expect she'll make it a big issue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Who's your winner?
The winner, as Mary said, the Democrats on the national level, it would have to be the Republicans on the local level, because they have gotten the Foxconn deal. It is their plan. They're the ones who have to live with it, whether it works or doesn't work. They get the credit if it works, and they get the blame if it doesn't.
Okay. So we have a couple of questions from our viewers. Let's start with Tiffany. She says, didn't Hillary win the presidential vote in New Jersey, New York, Virginia, and Washington State? Donald Trump lost in those states. So please tell me why I should be so excited about the Democratic Party for winning states they should win anyway.
So this is presumably a Trump supporter who is kind of trying to undermine the Democratic wins. You know, it's not that I think that...
Or it could be a Democrat who's...
Possibly, yeah.
Doesn't know whether she should believe or not.
Right. Hillary won in Virginia, but I think that... what was it, like nearly double the margin this time around?
So that shows
that it wasn't just same, that more people, either there was more enthusiasm where Democrats turned out who skipped last time,
and the coalition, or they flipped. The coalition that helped the Virginia governor, he benefited largely from white women as well as minorities and others and the white women, as I said earlier, supported Trump overall. So there's a shift with that. And obviously Trump's numbers right now aren't very good with a 36% approval rating. One other thing, I mean, it is true that in Virginia, that in the gubernatorial election after presidential, it almost always goes the other way. The last five times it's gone, and I think it's like 12 of the last 13 times, it's gone opposite of the way the nation has gone. So, I mean, there is some truth to that, but still, it would have been big, big news if Republicans had won in those cases, and you can guess that the Republicans would have gone nuts about that.
So there's this question about Trumpism without Trump.
Right, immediately after the election, Trump, Breitbart News, and Republican media went after Gillespie, saying that he didn't run the right way, that he didn't run as a Trumpian,
and he's fairly moderate. I mean, for Republicans these days.
Yeah, but at the same time, he did do stuff like saying he embraced keeping Confederate monuments and a few things like that. So. Mm-hmm.
So we have time for one more. Heather wants to know, following up on your discussion about polarization in Wisconsin, what do each of you think about Donald Trump and how he's contributed to that? And do you think it will get better or worse? Are we on the road to prosperity or doom?
Vice is going to say doom.
Well, as I said earlier, we're locked into a state that is very much divided. Yeah. I don't think, you know, Wisconsin did not welcome him when he came here,
right.
Did not respond very well to his attacks on Scott Walker. But when the choice came down to Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, they, people here made the choice for Trump, not by a big number. It was it was a very close race, and the turnout by Democrats was underwhelming. So,
right.
Especially among African Americans.
That seems to be the difference, though, in Virginia. Virginia Democrats turned out, minorities turned out, and even Republicans in Virginia were saying they just killed us because they came to vote.
But here they underperformed, particularly in Milwaukee.
It wasn't true here. It wasn't true here.
People were talking about suppressing the vote. You know, the biggest suppressor of the vote was Hillary Clinton, because people just didn't want to come out and vote for her.
So let's talk about, we didn't talk about this, but have you followed
are
the
you
Donna,
going to the Hillary event?
The Donna Brazil.
Which is some crazy stuff in there.
Yeah, I mean, she's basically saying, I was ready to take her off the ballot. Not that she could personally, but wow, after the fainting spell at the 9/11 memorial.
What's not clear to me is still how sick Hillary was. I know a lot of people started saying she wasn't very sick, and the media seemed to buy into that, but Donna Brazile seems to be saying she was, and that she was thinking about putting together the ticket of Biden and who was Cory Booker.
Cory Booker.
And that's who she wanted to put on the ballot, which would have been a strong ballot. I mean, a strong
team.
Yeah, I
think it would be.
But did Donna Brazile know something that we didn't know, that she was more ill than we thought? The other thing is the deal that was struck between the Clinton campaign and the DNC about how the Clinton campaign basically got to run the DNC. And, you know, all this talk about was the election rigged or not rigged, it certainly looks like someone had their thumb on the scale.
The Bernie-crats are up in arms about that.
And saying that they offered the same thing to Bernie's team, well, his team didn't have the sort of money, wasn't going to raise the sort of money that Hillary would. It is the sort of book that, usually tell-alls don't tell all, but this one seems to be going in that direction.
Tell a lot. And she also says, apparently, that she was not happy that it took 3 months to get a phone call from Hillary after the election. So there might be some other things going on there.
Maybe they weren't so tight.
It was funny to see her on Tucker Carlson's show, and they were quite chummy. Yeah.
And former Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark posted a photo
that
of her.
He ran into her, and though we were bonded, miles away from each other, it's good that she's speaking honestly about Hillary Clinton.
All right.
I'm just glad I don't have to worry about him every day.
Yeah, no.
Oh, you miss him.
I'm sure you do miss him, actually. Has he unblocked you yet?
I haven't checked.
Okay.
I'll do that right after
the show. Yeah, check after the show and tweet it out. All right, that's our show for this week. Thanks so much. I'm David Haynes with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks to Craig Gilbert, Mary Spacuzza, Dan Bison, Jason Stein, and thanks to you for joining us.